Okay, hi, and welcome again, friends, to our ongoing discussion of A Treatise on White Magic. We're working on the rules of magic for the physical plane, and I've decided to number these a little differently. I've done two programs now for the physical plane, and I'm just going to call them number one and number two instead of number 61 and 62, continuing from the astral plane the way I was doing before. I think it will be clearer because all of the numbering that occurs for the first set of rules for the mental plane are done in a contained manner, and then I started over again with the astral plane. So there are 50 programs for the introduction and the mental plane, 59 programs for the astral plane, and I'm just beginning here. It's a shorter section with number 1, 2, and now 3. And we've reached that point where we are discussing pain, okay. And we're discussing those types of lives who feel pain through anticipation, through memory, and the ability to look forward, because they are individualized and self-conscious. They not only feel the pain, but they feel the pain psychologically before it even occurs. And those other lives who are not individualized, and it says here, they feel no aggravation and no clear revolt, because they are lacking will and planned intent. So the form does decay, but they know not pain or loss or deprivation, poverty. This is one of the, well, this is one of the accompaniments of individualization, to be able to anticipate and compare what might be coming with what has occurred in the past. Okay, now let us see. A word about pain might be in place here, though I have naught of an abstruse nature to communicate anent the evolution of the human hierarchy through the medium of pain. And, you know, let's remember that this is the fourth creative hierarchy we're talking about. We speak of the hierarchy of human monads as the fourth creative hierarchy. And pain is especially associated with Ray 4 and with Ray 2, because of the sensitivity of both of those, and I suppose we might say also with Ray 6, with the entire 2-4-6 line. The devas do not suffer pain, as does mankind. I mean, I suppose there is pain, but they don't suffer as mankind does. Their rate of rhythm is steadier, although in line with the law, and I suppose that the contrasts are responsible for a more acute feeling of pain. I guess the devas that have achieved self-consciousness, either from having been in the human kingdom or along their own line, will have that same kind of anticipation as mankind has. He says they learn through application to the work of building and through incorporation their bodies are built into the form of that which is built. They're not learning so much through destruction the way mankind is. You kind of wonder whether some ray associated with the human kingdom is not the perhaps the first ray of the destroyer. So the devas learn through application to the work of building and through incorporation into the form which is being built, they grow through appreciation of and joy in the forms built and the work accomplished. I think that this particular section is also transported into other books. It's one of the excellent sections contrasting the attitude of the devas and the attitude of conscious man. The conscious deva's attitude, that is. The devas build and humanity breaks. Now, that looks to me like a contrast between the form-building ray, the second, and the ray of the destroyer, the first. And I suppose on some level, humanity will represent or have or be qualified by the ray of the destroyer, the first ray. So, second ray, and first ray. Now that's fourth ray. We don't want that. Okay, let's see. First ray. The devas build and humanity breaks, and through the shattering of the forms, man learns through discontent. The content of what man is can never be contained in any real finite form. Man is an infinite being, so is everything, essentially at root infinite. And, well, at least, even if we discount infinitude, we can say that man realizes his much grander scope than that which is contained within the form he must, at this time, perforce use. Always better and more adequate forms will be built, but still there is a discontent, a discontent in the realization that the ring pass not inhibits the full expression of what the essential man really is. Thus is acquiescence in the work of the greater builders achieved. At first, man is the rebel, we might say, and non-acquiescing. At first, man is the rebel, and he resembles in that way his Father in heaven, his planetary logos, whom we are told has the psychology of the rebel. Pain is that upward struggle through matter which lands a man at the feet of the logos. You know, it's the, you might say, the analogy that is close to hand is the salmon at the end of its life cycle, swimming upstream, braving all the dangers, being battered by the downflow of the water and the rocks, and jumping and being eaten by the bears, you know, until finally there is the possibility of return, and then death, the release of death. Pain is that upward struggle through matter which lands a man at the feet of the logos. Pain is the following of the line of greatest resistance. This is, again, sounding like the first ray component in the fourth creative hierarchy, and thereby reaching the summit of the mountain. The initiate truly is the mountain climber. He could stay on the plains, he could live in the valleys, but he chooses to fight against gravitation and achieve a summit of capacity and a summit of realization. Pain, this is marvelous stuff here. Pain is the smashing of the form and the reaching of the inner fire, which is the essence, the true reality of the being. Pain is the cold of isolation which leads to the warmth of the central sun. And here we might think of the central sun as the monad, the central spiritual sun in man. Pain is the burning in the furnace, in order finally to know the coolness of the waters of life, the passing through many burning grounds, we can say is a painful process, the passage across many burning grounds is a painful but necessary process, purifying and liberating. Pain is the journey into the far country. We're reminded of the prodigal son, resulting in the welcome to the father's home, a great release and relief after suffering long in apparent isolation. All isolation really is a question of consciousness. There is no real isolation from the essence of life. Pain is the illusion of the father's disowning. You know, the church has made much of that in terms of excommunication, the illusion of excommunication, and I suppose the depriving of all the benefits of heaven and the higher states, and an assurance that one will spend eternity in hell on this tiny little planet. There's so much that just doesn't make sense that people have accepted, but okay, they accept. So the illusion of the father's disowning, and there is one factor which seems to be universal in the human psyche, and that is the desire not to be cut off, because there's an inherent knowledge that that from which one appears to be cut off is oneself or one's other selves. There's a dramatic lessening of one's scope and quality with the apparent cutting off from others, and even more cutting off from the great lives in the heavenly worlds, and finally cutting off from God. But I guess we human beings can be excused at first for thinking in simplistic terms. That's all we have, is the simplicity of our mind, and it will grow until we estimate correctly what is the nature of life. That's what we're suffering from right now, a very poor estimation of what is the nature of human reality. So it's the illusion of disowning which drives the prodigal, the monad that has gone forth, straight to the father's heart. Pain is the cross of utter loss, experienced really at the fourth initiation, and thus we might say that fourth initiation is very much the fourth ray and the fourth initiation that are associated with each other are very much associated with pain. Pain is the cross of utter loss that renders back the riches of the eternal bounty. When we give all is given. When we give all for the good cause, all is returned, because in a way we not only have all, but more ontologically, we are all. Pain is the whip that drives the struggling builder to carry to utter perfection the building of the temple. You know, it's as if to say, oh, that stone does not go here. Oh, that stone is not ready. It's not clean. It's not polished enough. It's not shaped correctly. It's these boundaries provided by pain which remind us of the inadequacy of the building materials we would offer to the building of the temple, and then they contribute to the perfecting of those materials. I think so often the artist suffers greatly over the inadequacy of the creation in progress, and through a deep psychological pain tries to bring them into the correct condition through a process of constant refinement. I think anybody who's been in the arts knows that this is true. I am remembering, you know, my own work in the opera and in the music field, and one would suffer agonies if the production was not fitting, not correct, not beautiful, you know. So the discipline of beauty is very great, and we're told that in the fourth ray ashram, a very extreme form of discipline is applied, I suppose, relating to whether the product created is truly beautiful and maybe true and good along with that, as those three must go together in the art of the future, which will be more the occult art. With the problem of limitation is closely linked that of liberation. We have been discussing the way limitation is a part of the creative process and necessary, but basically, in a way, antithetical to the nature of the spirit, which is an infinite nature. Infinite, the infinite deity, that is what we essentially are, even though we seem to be extremely finite. But remove the veils upon our self-perception and remove our preoccupation with the various rings pass not, which constitute our form, and we begin to realize that our expanse, our scope, is far more than we ever thought. And finally, we will discover, along with the along with the universal logos, that that scope is not contained, it's boundless, it is infinite. Into the prison house of form enter all that live. Form is a selection of a certain, we might say, quantity of the infinite possibilities, but form, except for the form of the absolutely infinite, post-pralayic in nature, is not infinite. So into the prison house of reduced perception or form, reduced self-perception, I'm calling form reduced self-perception. You know, we can have a discussion about that. Reduced self-perception. Into the prison house of form enter all that live. Some enter consciously and some unconsciously. And this we call birth, appearance, incarnation, manifestation. Well, we've been doing this for a long time as a human being for millions of years. There's probably no human being on the planet, except maybe for very rare incarnations from other planets for specific purposes, that has not been doing this process of birth, appearance, incarnation, manifestation for millions of years. Even if you came from the moon chain, it's still millions of years. If you came from the earlier solar system, it's certainly millions of years. And the time of individualization for Earth chain humanity was following 18 and a half million years ago. And I suppose it went on for a while, into the Atlantean period. So millions of years of this process, all forgotten, I suppose, because we have drunk too deeply of the of Lethe, the river of forgetfulness coming into form, coming into birth. And I suppose that is a very good thing because otherwise we wouldn't be able to handle what is set before us if we were burdened by constant recollections of all the multitude of encounters that had gone on before. Immediately there sweeps into activity another law, or the working out of an active principle, which we call the law of cycles. And when we talk about all knowledge garnered on the third subplane of the atomic plane, we must include very much the science of cycles. This is the principle of periodic appearance, a beneficent operation of the lower wisdom, lower wisdom of innate divinity. For it produces that sequence of the states of consciousness which we term time. Now, without sequence, there would be no time, and without a curtailed self-perception, there would be no sequence. And that is a choice of the self-observing becomer. We can say creator, but I like the idea of self-becoming as responsible for creation. So the sequence of the states of consciousness is not available to the one who sees all simultaneously. I suppose there is movement, but the sequence of one thing after another, well, it is somewhat altered. And for the one who sees only essence and not quality, then time disappears. So anyway, this law of cycles provides the means by which we grow through the re-presentation of opportunity. And we undergo periodic recharging or rejuvenation so that we can encounter new scenes and new experiences, new circumstances productively, growthfully. So via spiral cyclic motion, we grow into a condition of fitness which allows our release from the prison house of form. In our horoscopes, we know that the moon is particularly associated with the prison of form. It's all that has been gathered from the past and is repetitive and provides circumstances which are not new and from which we must gain release. Anyway, this produces, therefore, in the world field of awareness, a gradual and slow growth towards self-expression, self-appreciation, because we don't really know what we are entirely by any means, given our limited consciousness, and self-realization. Where we realize we are far more than the form in which the consciousness, and our powers are temporarily limited. Expression, appreciation, realization, that's an important, sequence. When Yogananda has the Self-Realization Fellowship, he's not talking about the personality as the self, not by any means, but as speaking of the one life, the great substratum that we not only all share, but essentially and finally all are. To these principles of limitation and of cycles is added another principle, and that of expansion. So, and we think particularly astrologically of Jupiter, we think of the growth of consciousness. We don't so much think of the growth of being. We might think of growth in the ability to register being or ourselves as being, but being doesn't grow. Being is what it is. It is pure isness, and it is identical in all self-perceptions and potential self-perceptions. So this brings about the development of consciousness so that the latent germ of sentiency or of sensitive response to environment may be fostered in the living unit. A simple way of saying this is our consciousness is constantly expanding and deepening. And I'm sure we've noticed that over our lives. Sometimes, recently had an experience meeting an individual. Well, I hadn't seen the individual maybe for 40 years. And before that time, contact was pretty constant. And I just noticed the different ways that our consciousnesses had either expanded or not expanded. I think there was expansion, but along different lines, and a taking in of much more than we had been aware of in earlier days, even if we disagreed about the value of the kind of expansion that each was experiencing. So there are three principles here, and they are involved in all the creative process for those entering form. This is the key. And all lives will enter that prison house of form. Necessarily, this is the mode of growth, well, as far as we know, not only with on our planet and in our solar system, but in throughout the universe. Maybe we're wrong to generalize, but and of course, when you enter into limitation, the spirit, which is boundless in a way, experiences pain. So here are the three principles: limitation, periodic manifestation, and expansion. I'm reminded of the three fundamentals that we have so far of the secret doctrine. So these principles either accord or show themselves as opposite to those fundamentals. We have, number one, a boundless, immutable principle, and limitation is the very opposite of that. We have, number two, the law of periodicity, and this principle of periodic manifestation is in accord with this law of periodicity. We have, then, the identity of every soul with the oversoul. And I suppose we can say that as a consciousness, we expand into the consciousness of the oversoul, which consciousness we have and are more essentially before we committed ourselves via the principle of limitation to a sphere of far more limited consciousness. So essentially, we are the oversoul, at least in the universe, and because there is a time when there is no universe, which means, I suppose, that there is no limited self-objectivity, as in the post-Pralaic period. There are times when no universe exists, but the being, the great absolute deity, and then finally the absoluteness, they do exist, though no universe per se exists, all universes being inherent possibilities within the absolute deity. Can we think so big? Do we dare think in such an enlarged manner? Does it seem fanciful or even a little bit crazy to think of the self in that way? But I suppose by quieting the outer apparatus and allowing it to fade from sight, other things come into our range of vision and of identification, those other things being far more expansive, and we do identify with them. I mean, if somebody says, I am the light of the world, what has happened to the normal identification with the, as it's sometimes called, the skin encapsulated ego? What has happened? There's been a huge disidentification with limitation and a great expansion of identification into light. I am the love of the world. I am the will of the world. All those things. I am the isness, the being of the world. I am isness wherever it exists, and it exists everywhere. So what happens to the consciousness when those kinds of identifications are accepted as true, not only accepted, but maybe realized as true? Anyway, these three principles constitute the factors underlying the law of evolution, as men call it. Maybe there's another name for it, you know, which is somehow more fitting in from the perspective of the masters. But we are thrown into the world of limitation. We that are far less limited than the sphere into which we enter, at least psychologically and in terms of consciousness, far less limited. And this happens periodically. And as a result, the consciousness grows, and those constituents which have caused the limitation, they undergo an expansion and an elevation. I mean, without certain of the tiny lives, the lesser lives, the unconscious lives, the lives of the lesser kingdoms, there would be no limitation. But those aggregations are worked upon by the internally expanding consciousness, and these aggregations are vitalized in new ways, and their consciousness is increased, and within form our consciousness is increased, until we return to the realization that higher states of consciousness have always been ours. So these three, limitation, periodic manifestation, and expansion, all of them, they are the factors underlying the law of evolution. Well, we tend to think of our evolution now largely in terms of form. We certainly forget all about the process of involution unless we study theosophy and look at the larger cycle which it suggests as factual. And eventually we begin to realize that the form itself can only evolve to a certain point in any one round. and we begin to look for the evolution of consciousness. When we study comparative anatomy, let us say in the schools, as part of the biological or medical curriculum, we're looking at the form. We're not looking at consciousness at all, but eventually it will be possible to understand the scope of consciousness of the various confined lives. And certainly we number ourselves, we human beings, as among the confined lives. We may be individualized and have the potential to become unconfined and have our boundaries removed, but they have that potential too. And once individualization is achieved by the rising lower kingdoms, they will be able to direct themselves forward more rapidly and by choice. So the law of evolution, these three bring about the imprisonment of life in its various appearances or aspects, and hence the, let us call it the great variety of forms existent. They produce the environing forms. Yes, okay. And they lead the imprisoned lives on into ever more educational prison houses. Okay. I find myself anticipating what the Tibetan is going to say here, or maybe vaguely remembering from a while ago when the reading of this section took place, probably repeatedly. Educational, or in other words, prisons in which the light could more easily penetrate. DK had an analogy for a man who had a third-rate soul and a sixth-rate personality, and he was very afflicted by glamour, and DK said, well, you're like in a darkened room, but here is a little window. And it's a dirty window and much obstructed. The coming in of the light is much obstructed. So clean your window, you know. And I think for many of us, that is a good analogy. We're in a darkened room. He talks about that in connection with the fourth ray at one point. In this man's case, it was a question of glamour, and there was no transparency. There was just maybe a little bit of translucence, the flowing in of some light if it wasn't being mostly blocked. But as we clean our window, we can, the light comes in and we find ourselves much more aware of what's outside our darkened room. Maybe our darkened room becomes a light. Maybe we can look outside the window. Maybe we can even find the door and open it and step out into a world that we hardly expected. I'm remembering a film, it was Les Miserables, you know, Victor Hugo's great novel. And at the end, I think the hero, he really is a hero, Jean Valjean, he finally dies, and in the film at least, it has him somehow stepping into the other world, and how expansive it is, and how many he meets there who have passed over, and it's such a contrast with the confined condition in which he existed as he was weakening on the physical plane. Always there is a door, and there is a door to far greater life. Even for the universal logos, there is a door back into the post-pralayic state, which is absolutely infinite. Finally, the time arrives when the principle of liberation becomes active. Notice how time is required in this psychological setup of partial self-perception. The principle of liberation becomes active, and in our terms of our astrology, that's Uranus. So let's put that down. You know, when you have Uranus somewhere in the chart, you can be liberated from something, you know. Liberations occur along that line and through Aquarius. The four signs there being blinding light, Taurus, fiery pain, Leo, bitter woe, Scorpio, and liberation, Aquarius. And Uranus, as a lesser deity compared to the lord of the constellation Aquarius, contributes to that liberation. So many of the aberrations found in connection with Uranus are really motivated by the desire to break through boundaries and be liberated. So finally the time arrives when the principle of liberation becomes active, and a transition is effected out of a prison house which cramps and distorts into one which provides adequate conditions for the next development of consciousness. Well, you know, it's a, what can we call it? A bigger prison. Even the universe is a prison when compared with absolute infinitude. Now there is, you know, the absolute infinitude of which is articulated and has all manner of distinct possibility and interact action. You know, you can't conceive it. It's just beyond the possibility of conception, really, except a very inaccurate conception. And then there's the absolutely homogeneous infinitude of the absolute that is non-articulated, and all things are of one and the same substance, and any type of faculty is a great reduction upon the infinitized beingness. Well, I don't know what to call it. Infinitized beingness of the absolute state. Anything I say about it is wrong in these paltry things that are called words. And as the Tibetan says, he is much limited by words, which one day he has to release. He's bound many little lives into to convey his thoughts, and the day of liberation for them too must come. What that would look like, well, who knows? It is interesting here to note that death is governed by the principle of liberation and not by that of limitation. We tend to forget that, and we tend to think that everything is taken from us, and we are limited down even to just being nothing at all and being annihilated and wiped away. Because we don't believe in what we cannot see, and we don't make the proper efforts to see what we cannot yet see. We just think that what you're presented with here in the world of the senses, that's it. But occult training teaches us that new forms of registration are possible. And for those who choose to follow that type of cultivation of ability, well, then they are rewarded by the sight, or the registration of the new forms. I use the word sight just, you know, not just for the sense of seeing, but meaning registration. Death is only recognized as a factor to be dealt with by self-conscious lives, and is only misunderstood by human beings who are the most glamored and deluded of all incarnated lives. Well, that's a great little paragraph or sentence we might want to forget. But it's a bit like saying that the occult groups of the world are the most glamored of all the groups in the world. But death is only recognized as a factor to be dealt with by self-conscious lives. So, you know, the little atoms and molecules and lower forms of life and the lower phyla and They do not anticipate death. There's a change, but they don't know what that change is. And they are alive and well, registering whatever impacts come to them in other dimensions. But death is only misunderstood by human beings, who are the most glamored and deluded of all incarnate lives. Incarnated lives. Let's just see here. The other higher lives know what death is and do not misunderstand. I guess solar angels are not misunderstanding death, and these higher hierarchies that have been through the human stage. Okay, let's see if I can save as. It tends to give me a little bit of a problem here. And I'm just hoping that it works. All right. Because if I lose the original document, I'm in trouble. All right. So, I guess the main point here is that death, do we think so when we think of it? That death is governed by the principle of liberation and not by that of limitation. You can imagine that there is a human being engaged in a very limited process, but he knows the process must be completed. And so, although he knows that a great expansion of possibility may lie ahead and much increased joy, he would prefer to continue in the state of limitation until the task is done, because someday it must be done. So why delay? After many longings for happiness and greater joy, finally comes down to why delay the correct handling of that which is perhaps more limited and less joyful, because it must be done. That's often the way I feel, Sometimes people have said, "Well, look, I can see that you decided to stay here when you had some opportunities to exit." And I've had a few. It doesn't make sense to me to exit into greater joy and bliss when, in fact, a return must come so completion will be achieved. So on we go. All right, now, the next point to be noted is that each kingdom in nature acts in two ways. Number one, as a liberator of the kingdom of forms, which has not reached its particular stage of conscious awareness, helping, we might say, okay. Now I've got a little problem here. Helping the kingdom below to rise, helping that. And as a prison house of lives that have transmitted into it, transmitted into it from the level of consciousness next beneath it. Transmitted into it. That's interesting. Okay. I hope that this interruption of sounds indicating some difficulty in saving does not continue. So it lifts the forms below it, and yet it is a more expanded prison house, a more expanded prison for the up and coming lives. So any state characterized by a definite limited number is a prison. I'll just say that. And strangely, although it's part of the law, and we'll understand why as we rise again and yet again, that even the universe is a prison upon the limitless possibilities of absolute infinitude. The whole dynamic of life is this alternation between absolute infinitude and a parallel finitude. Let it be remembered that each field of awareness in its boundaries consists of a prison. Well, you know, I'm always saying something, and then DK comes along and says it better, for sure. Let it be remembered always that each field of awareness in its boundaries constitutes a prison. Remember that the absolute is the boundless, immutable principle, boundless, and that the objective of all work of liberation is to release the consciousness and expand its fields of contacts. Okay. So always the more is required of us, and if the more is not entering our lives, well, we're just not growing. So we come forth into prison, into finitude, and do we really learn anything new that has not been completely given as a possibility in absolute infinitude? I'm not sure exactly how to think about that. But we come forth into finitude, and then we release ourselves from that self-imposed limitation. Where there are boundaries of any kind, where a field of influence is circumscribed and where the radius of contact is limited, you have a prison. Well, I guess DK and I are saying the same thing, and probably I learned it from him. Let's see, I'm going to just have to somehow do that. It seemed like such a very important statement, and making it rather bigger so that it will stand out. Where there are boundaries of any kind. You see, that's why we have the bounded immutable principle. There's one boundless, rather, immutable principle. So it's completely unlimited. And when we say boundless, we don't just mean in terms of space. We'd have to think in terms of time and number. It's called the no number by Blavatsky, or the absolute zero, which is not nothing, but the essence of everything. Where there are boundaries of any kind, there is a field of influence, where a field of influence is circumscribed, and where the radius of contact is limited, there you have a prison. So he's going to have us ponder on this, and I've been kind of offering us the opportunity to ponder in that way, you know, suggesting my own sort of self-derived Vedantic perspectives. But DK is really, he's saying the same thing. He doesn't necessarily focus on such matters to a great extent, because he has to deal with all of us trapped in various layers of the world of illusion. And that's where the liberation has to occur. But behind it all are these realizations that are very much like the what is found in the secret doctrine and in the Brahmanical and Upanishadic and Vedantin texts. So ponder on this statement, for it holds much of truth. and we're doing that, where there is an apprehension of a vision and of a wide unconquered territory of contacts, then there will inevitably be a sense of imprisonment and of cramping. Well, that's it. I mean, if we look ahead and we say, oh my goodness, look how much more there is, and we look at our present state, then we say we're in prison because I see more, so much more could be engaged with. And I lived in cribbed, cabined, and confined circumstances compared with what might be possible. Where there is a realization of worlds to conquer, of truths to be learnt. Here he's speaking as that great second ray that he is, you know, the mind ever bent on new learning and realization, of conquests to be made, of desires to be achieved, of knowledges to be mastered. There you will have the festering sense of limitation, goading on the aspirant to renewed effort and driving the living entity on along the path of evolution. This is wonderfully repeated, and I just feel that it needs to be accentuated. So, you know, you can have a very expansive area in which you live, relatively, compared with less expansive areas. But when you look ahead at all of these possibilities, worlds to conquer, truths to be learnt, conquests to be made, desires to be achieved, knowledges to be mastered, as you're going through the various of the seven rays, there you will have this festering, rotting, you know, this diseased, uncomfortable sense of limitation, which, to relieve it, goads the aspirant to renewed effort and drives the living entity on along the path of evolution. So, for a while, you know, we reach the top of a mountain, and we look around, look below, and feel an exaltation at being above so many lesser circumstances, but then we might look up and in the distance and find a still greater mountain or many mountains and realize how inevitable it is that we have to climb one after another because we're not going to be leaping from peak to peak. Instinct governing the vegetable and animal kingdoms develops into intellect in the human family. We see what we are doing, and what we're doing naturally, prompted as we are by the higher lives, even though we are unconscious. And then we sort of take hold of that doingness and direct it from within ourselves rather than just letting it happen. Later, intellect merges into the intuition, and intuition into illumination. So here he's giving the order of these. And sometimes, well, you know, he talks about the steps in the meditative process. Leo, concentration, Virgo, meditation, Libra, contemplation, Scorpio, illumination, Sagittarius, inspiration, and Capricorn, initiation. It's not exactly the same sequence, but you get the idea. And maybe this illumination is, by comparison, on the atmic plane compared to the intuition of the Buddhic plane. When the superhuman consciousness is evoked, these two, intuition, Atma-Buddhi, maybe, or Buddhi-Atma, intuition and illumination take the place of instinct and intelligence. Now, what I'm going to do is say that, okay, 1, 2, 3. This is the end of hour one and program number 3. and rule 12.3. And we're going to, you know, he's trying to talk to us about liberation here. And I think I'm reaching the point where I could reset my chronometer, which got, which ran into difficulty some time ago, and perhaps record timing more accurately. So that's what I'll do. We're going to get into this discussion of what illumination is. It's such a word that is applied to graded states, just the way samadhi is applied to graded states, ever higher degrees of samadhi, you know, or enlightenment, the enlightenment of the third degree initiate undergoing the transfiguration is not the same as the enlightenment of a Buddha who was having a cosmic touch of the cosmic mental plane. So I'll be right back, and we'll go on into hour number two. Okay, so here we are. Going on in program number three, dealing with rules for magic on the physical plane. And we have talked about the various states through which a man may pass from instinct to intellect, and thence to intuition, and thence to illumination. I think from intellect, Alice Bailey's book. What is that book? From intellect to intuition, something like that. I'm just finding myself a little bit nonplussed here. And, I see what the problem is. Right, I'm going to, from instinct to intuition, what is the name of the book? From intellect to intuition. So we see we've left out instinct, which precedes intellect, and at least in this listing, we've left out the illumination, and I suppose initiation confers various degrees of illumination. So, illumination, what does it lead to? Straight to the summit of achievement, to the fulfillment of cyclic destiny. To the fulfillment of cyclic destiny. To the emergence of the radiant glory, to wisdom, power, and God consciousness, which is, we might call it oneness consciousness. You know, under Gemini, it talks about the service of my brother, and then finally serving of the one, which is realized, and service of the whole. So under the disciple and initiate in esoteric astrology, page 332, we have here for the disciple and initiate, I serve the one, coming in under Gemini, and the whole is seen as one. See, the one self, always the wholeness coming in under the kind of consciousness which the disciple and even more the initiate displays. Yeah, well, we want to have a consciousness of oneness, homogeneous oneness, and also a consciousness of articulated oneness. All of the many, many things that perception reveals, seen within the one and as the one. So that's what illumination leads to. And they're all degrees, as I said before, there are all degrees of illumination. These words, however, mean but little or nothing in comparison with a reality which can only be sensed by any human being when his intuition is awakened and his mind illumined. So, at least let there be a Buddhic consciousness and even nirvanic, atmic consciousness. Interesting that the atmic plane is called the nirvanic plane, and everybody struggles so hard to reach the state of nirvana as if it is a conclusion, but we learn, you know, in the Evans Wentz books that nirvana is but the beginning of the endless way. Is it endless? In any universe, it's not endless, but given the fact that universes never began and always were alternating with non-universes, which is hard to grasp, we are on the endless way. So, grasping these facts anent, imprisonment, how, to be practical, can a man become a releasing agent for the prisoners of the planet? So, you know, obviously, we must understand what imprisonment really is. And he is instructing us. We cannot be liberated from our prison unless we know we are actually in a prison. Well, I suppose maybe the prison can burn down, or the waters can smash it, or the winds carry it away, or whatever, but I'm talking about a conscious liberation from the imprisoned state. And if any of us wakes up and looks at this marvelous world and says, yes, it's beautiful, and it is a prison, the attitude will be different. I mean, you know, on the subtle planes, if you hear the Gandharvas or the sirens singing, you may want to stop and be entranced by the beauty and give up the quest for liberation, because you are so magnetized by the song. But if we realize, wait a second, this is an alluring, entrapping, imprisoning, however beautiful, song, what do we do about that? What do we do about that? And then we learn how to free ourselves through detachment. And that is not easy, because there's so much that one has to give up, which is attractive. So we can understand how in the next solar system, the second ray, with its great attractiveness, can provide an energy which is used by the forces of obstruction, when in fact we want to be liberated into the divine will in that will solar system. So we have a relativity here concerning the goodness of attraction, and it depends on what kind of context we're dealing with. What can humanity as a whole achieve along this line? And what can the individual do? These are very practical questions. How really do we, as intended liberators of the prisoners of the planet, actually liberate? How do we do it? So the task of humanity falls primarily into three divisions of labor. I mean, we want to know how we can help. This is one of the ways we can help with regard to the divine plan. Sometimes we say, well, what is the plan? We don't know. How does it apply to me? We don't know. How can I help? We don't know. But we are being instructed. And I think any serious thought about light, love, and power and their necessity will reveal to us at least the outlines of the divine plan and what we can do to be of assistance. I sometimes ask myself why I'm doing what I'm doing, you know, and basically, you know, there is the joy of reading through the Tibetans' books this way, and so many of us have read them and, you know, certainly more than once and studied, but I seek to make bridges, I seek to make links, you know, to help bring different aspects of the teaching together so that a greater light may shine. I guess we all have our reasons for what we're doing, what it is we do. Let's just try to be sure of them and that they, in fact, connect with the manifestation of the divine plan. The plan comes first. So three groups of prisoners can be released and will eventually find their way out of their prison house through the instrumentality of man. Already human beings are working in all three fields. Three groups of prisoners. Well, all of this is how one works under the attenuated influence of a Lord of Liberation, you know, in Shambhala. Liberty, equality, and fraternity. Let's see if I can get this correct. All right. The prisoners within the human form, and this involves working with one's fellow men, and maybe that's what most of us do. I mean, maybe not so many of us are working with the lower kingdoms in a very concerted way. Prisoners within the animal kingdom, and already much is being done within this field. One is reminded of the people who work with specific animal populations, such as, let's say, the mountain gorillas. Was it Jane Goodall? Was that the name? They sacrificed their lives to do this. And the people who try to prevent the poaching that's going on and thus the destruction of so many animals. Unintended destruction, I would say. And these people who counter that, they risk their lives too. Prisoners within the forms of the vegetable world, the beginning has been made here. Luther Burbank, maybe. Was he not a great friend of Yogananda and providing some of these beautiful gardens that surround the Self-Realization Fellowship in Encinitas? And there are other places where these fellowships exist, I think in Los Angeles area, I'm not sure where else. And you kind of wonder, with all that has gone on with respect to the nuclear fission and intended nuclear fusion, whether some kind of liberation of the lives of the mineral kingdom is not in process. Because radioactivity is a high state when compared to the usual state of the mineral, or maybe of any lives within any kingdom. There is a radioactive period which is advanced and high. And as one works towards the liberation of these beings trapped in certain forms, the inducement or the induction of radioactivity is to be desired. Radioactive man, you know, is kind of the disciple initiate, and there are animal, plant, and mineral forms where radioactivity is occurring. It's just that we think only in terms of the mineral kingdom when we think of a word like radioactivity, but the Tibetan's books instruct us on the different possible forms of radioactivity. So man, working with one's fellow men, this is probably the most widespread form of helping release the prisoners. It's been said that the proper study of mankind is man, and I don't think the majority of us has the ability to work scientifically, really, really productively with liberating the members of the animal, vegetable, and mineral kingdom, maybe next in line, because closer to us in this process of liberation come the animals and those who work with them. We see a lot of work with animal training and increasing animal intelligence and all that kind of thing. It's really sometimes very beautiful to see as we work with the domestic animals and they begin to verge towards the state of individualization. Now, even though that individualization is more likely to occur or is slated to occur in the next round for so many of the presently domesticated animals, some few do make it into the individualized state in this particular round. I was kind of surprised to see that, but when some animal owners say of their domestic animals, well, this dog, my cat, whatever, my elephant, whatever, is almost human, they really mean it. And the possibility of liberation into the human kingdom is there. All right, much work is being accomplished by man for men, and through the agency of scientific, religious, and educational endeavor, the human consciousness is steadily expanding until one by one the sons of God are breaking through their limitations into the world of souls. So this is the okay, that was a jump. So this is a change of kingdoms. Our goal as human beings, especially those who have had quite a bit of experience, our goal is to become members of the kingdom of souls of the fifth kingdom of nature. And this is certainly open to many at this point. So, breaking through limitations, and it's almost like a relationship between Uranus and Saturn. Let's just say radioactivity is that which can be used to break through Saturnian limitation. So it's Uranus over Saturn. And it's interesting what happens when there are the two of them are found together in conjunction. It's quite a battle between limitation and breaking through. But at least, well, this is not so much about astrology, but if the breakthrough occurs, then it can be put into proper form rapidly with Uranus present. So science is educating many. The religious approach, the same. General education is providing a greater light and expanding the awareness. There's just so many more things we touch and which impact us at the close of our educational process, if it ever ends, really, than when we first entered. Think of what you knew in the first grade and what you knew when you graduated from college. In the retrospect of history, The picture of the emerging prisoner, man, can be seen in clear delineation. I'm reminded of a great piece of music by Beethoven in his one opera, Fidelio, and the prisoners that have long been kept in jungles are not dungeons, pardon me, dungeons, long in dungeons, are released into the light, and their love of the light which they greet is presented in a very beautiful piece of choral music, and it's just so full of reverence for the light of which they have been long deprived. The emerging prisoner, it stimulated that thought in me because they come up out of the dungeon into the light. The jungle, too, as far as that goes, is a is not necessarily a state of clarity, but a state of great danger, and one can emerge from the jungle and see the great plains and wider scope for freedom. In the retrospect of history, the picture of the emerging prisoner man can be seen in clear delineation. I suppose there are retrogressive periods, and there are periods when greater light has shone than at present. But gradually the trend is ever upward. You know, if we have this sort of sine wave, it's an ascending sine wave. It doesn't just stay on the same level. So there may be these dips compared to a peak, but overall the process is one of ascension. Little by little, he has mastered the planetary boundaries. I mean, we're flying now. We have rockets, maybe, that also took place in Atlantean times, but here we are again, mastering the boundaries. Before there were boats, every great body of water was a boundary. And the air was certainly a boundary before we could lift off through aviation. At least in our day and age, those periods around the beginning of the 20th century helped us conquer the air. So the natural boundaries no longer contained man. Little by little, he has grown from the stage of caveman to that of a Shakespeare and Newton, Leonardo da Vinci and Einstein, a Saint Francis of Assisi to a Christ and a Buddha. Maybe we're saving, you know, the best for last here, the Christ and the Buddha. Cavemen apparently had some kind of art, and more is being discovered. I think when the second petal of the egoic lotus is stimulated, some form of artistic creativity is possible. But we get the idea. We were animal man, and we didn't have much intelligence. And even in the days of Atlantis, a few million years ago, there was not much intelligence, which has increased rapidly. So he's giving us the evolutionary picture here. Our emergence. We've been imprisoned by ignorance, and that's ending. Maybe all those things are imprisonment. Darkness, lovelessness, weakness in terms of the will. All of that suggests imprisonment. The capacity of man to achieve in any field of human expression seems practically unlimited. And if the past few thousand years have seen such a stupendous growth, what shall we see in the next 5,000 years. So he is looking ahead into the age of Aquarius, which will certainly be an age of many marvels scientifically achieved. And, well, the hidden energies will simply be noted and emerge into usefulness. If prehistoric man, little more than an animal, has grown into the genius, you know, the unfoldment of the fifth petal, doesn't happen before that, what unfoldment is not possible as more and more of innate divinity makes its presence felt? The Superman is with us, not the Superman in the false Aryan sense promoted by Germany in the Second World War, but the one who can truly achieve on the Buddhic and Atmic planes and beyond. So this is all this suggests a great hope for humanity. What will the world manifest when all mankind is tending towards a concrete manifestation of superhuman powers? This is the age of Aquarius. Look at the let's see if I can make this a little bigger. The very lowest of the creative hierarchies is ruled by Aquarius, and it will affect the etheric life and manifestation. It's going to bring higher powers before us in a concretized way. The concrete mind, so important in manifestation, will grow, but so will the ability to receive from the world of meaning, the soul, and from the world of intuition within the spiritual triad. And so our concretions will carry those higher energies, which right now we can only perhaps suppose as existent. Man's consciousness is being released in varying directions and dimensions. And there's so many of these dimensions, each new state of vibration, each new and intensified point of tension reveals a higher dimension, a still higher dimension. It is expanding into the world of spiritual realities and beginning to embrace the fifth or spiritual kingdom, which is done, I suppose, when we can focus within the higher mind, within the causal body, and even more so to focus, as do the majority of members of the hierarchy, within the spiritual triad. I guess maybe they all do. So this consciousness that we have is no longer so confined, so limited. It's touching spiritual realities and making it possible for more and more human beings to enter the spiritual kingdom, the kingdom of souls, the fifth kingdom. It is interpenetrating through scientific research the world of superhuman endeavor. I mean, we're told France will reveal scientifically the nature of the soul. That will take us in a scientific manner to the higher mental plane, and there are worlds beyond that, and minute atomic structures beyond that. He tells us the shape even of the Buddhic atoms, the atoms found on the Buddhic plane, kind of a figure eight, interestingly enough. So it is interpenetrating man's consciousness through scientific research. You know, now that we have, before this time, when this was written, there were no attempts to discover the subatomic particles. Now we're into particle physics and identifying of many events, which might be called etheric. So it is interpenetrating through scientific research the world of superhuman endeavor and investigating the many aspects of the form of God. There is that beautiful thing about the law of repulse, where the garment of God is the subject and the focus becomes a directedness towards the one who wears the garment, the one behind the garment, God itself, rather than simply the emanative garment. So we're investigating already, and that was back then, 90 years ago maybe, the many aspects of the form of God and of the forms that constitute, with a capital F, the larger form. I think in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna was shown, or rather Arjuna was shown by Krishna, the great unity of the form of God and all the many, many forms which inhered in the one form. See, where is that wonderful section? Let's say here, rings clear, right? Well, here it is, this third degree mantram. Look at this. Swept am I by the universal life, and as I sweep upon my onward way, the way of God, I see all lesser energies die out. I am the one, I God. Now watch this one. I am the form, should be almost capital F, in which all forms are merged. That's the form of God, which Krishna revealed to Arjuna. I am the soul in which all souls are fused. I am the life, and in that life all little lives remain. This is an ancient chant. Does it come from Atlantean times or... Yeah, Atlantean chant, which is no longer used, but in those far-off times was chanted by the initiate who took the third initiation, the consummating initiation of that period. But remember, too, that, I think it is true, the Christ and the Buddha took the third initiation together in a fourth ray ashram. Anyway, that third initiation was a consummating initiation of that period. And DK has translated the symbols through which this was presented, even though the rhythm, the necessary rhythm and the tonality of the chant was lost. And thus, I suppose, its true effectiveness. I mean, when you really, really think of what Master DK has given us here and how these different bestowals can be brought together to create new light, it's just extraordinary. And we have to learn how to absorb and interpret, reinterpret, and make our own presentations of combinations derived from the wealth of knowledge which has been given. So, Superman is with us. What will the world manifest when all mankind is tending towards a concrete manifestation of superhuman powers? Even in the Saturnian part of the new and coming age, let's just say the first roughly 720 years, there will be certainly a tendency towards concretion. Now, maybe the heights of Manus will not yet be reached, because probably they will be reached under Mercury, the next 720-year decanate period. Going on, man's consciousness is being released in varying directions and dimensions. It is expanding into the world of spiritual realities and beginning to embrace the fifth or spiritual kingdom, the kingdom of souls. So all of us, you know, we intend to function within the kingdom of souls. And even from the time of the first initiation, we're beginning very small way to enter that kingdom of souls. I know I read this, but it's worth it. It is interpenetrating through scientific research the world of superhuman endeavor, that is, I think, you know, coming shortly, and investigating the many aspects of the form of God and of the forms that constitute that form. So we should see nothing before us in isolation. All of these things are emanations, derivations, extensions of the original essence of our universal logos. In touching upon the work of humanity, see, that's what we're doing. We're saying, you know, what kind of release is coming? What prisoners of the planet are being released? And what role does humanity have in that release? In touching upon the work of humanity, in releasing the units of which it is constructed, and in releasing the prisoners in the vegetable and animal kingdom, I want to point out two things, both of profound importance. So, you know, I guess the question arising here is, are we liberators? Are we liberators? First, in order to release the prisoners of the planet that come under the title of subhuman, man has to work under the influence of the intuition. When working to release his fellow men, he has to know the meaning of illumination. And the way the lists are given here, illumination follows the intuition. But it's interesting, even in the very concrete work related to the subhuman kingdoms, intuition is required. When the true nature of service is comprehended, as apparently it is not yet, he wrote about that, you know, in Esoteric Psychology, Volume 2, it will be found that it is an aspect of that divine energy which works always under the destroyer aspect, for it destroys the forms in order to release. How interesting. Now, when the law is presented, the sixth ray is associated with it, but here is an association of service with the first ray, the destroyer. So let's think about that together. When the true nature of service is comprehended, it will be found that it is an aspect of that divine energy which works always under the destroyer aspect, for it destroys the forms in order to release. And, you know, the deva's service is much different from that. It builds forms which can imprison, you know, but always with greater beauty and possibility of more elaborate expression within those forms. Anyway, for man, let's just say, try to understand what service really does. Service is a manifestation of the principle of liberation, and of this principle, death and service constitute two aspects. Well, you know, it's been a while since I've read this book, but this is an amazing statement, and I hope that we all can kind of understand it. Service is a manifestation of the principle of liberation. Think about the service that you've offered. You know, you've given money, let's say. People on the other end can do more than before they could do. You've taught, you've brought the light. Knowledge allows the expansion of capacity of the one served. I was thinking about some people I know that bring water into Africa. They drill the wells for people who had no water. It's just amazing how confined, and as this individual says, how marginalized those lives really are. Well, but when they get the water, their time is liberated. They no longer have to walk miles every day to pick up water, carry it on their heads, or however they carry it. So the principle of liberation is there, and death and service constitute two aspects. I suppose the healer, who has the choice, according to intuition, of healing the form or sending the occupier of the form on his way into a more expansive world, that there is a choice there. It's serving in both ways, either healing the form or allowing the form to disintegrate and sending the occupier of the form into the expanded possibilities of a state in which the form is dropped. Death and service constitute two aspects of the principle of liberation. Well, I hope we can get that, and I hope we can understand that. Death and service. You usually hear about death and taxes, but it's so interesting how DK combines these here. Service saves, liberates, and releases. Saves is sometimes the saving of the form so the life can continue, or the regeneration of consciousness so that old addictions and attachments are dropped away. Service saves, liberates, and releases on various levels the imprisoned consciousness. And the same statement can be made of death. But unless service can be rendered from an intuitive understanding of all the facts of the case, interpreted intelligently and applied in the spirit of love upon the physical plane, it fails to fulfill its mission adequately. Oh, every one of these sentences is just packed with meaning. And I must admit that it's been a long time since I have thought of service and death in the same breath. Service saves, liberates, and releases. Think about how you intend to serve and how you do serve. Does it save? Does it liberate? Does it release? Is the imprisoned consciousness less imprisoned after you have fulfilled your gesture of service? And of course, the same statement can be made of death, that it saves, liberates, releases the imprisoned consciousness. I guess service, well, not exclusively, but it oftentimes tends to keep the consciousness within form and improves the quality of relationship between the consciousness and the form, and also improves the kind of environment in which the consciousness functions. If you're, let's say, taken out of the slum with no possibilities of education, and you are then taken to another place where education is now a possibility, well, that is, you're still within the form, but the form, the circumstances surrounding the form have been so greatly improved that the imprisoned consciousness experiences much less of a prison. I was That was very touching. This man, his name is Armand. He's a Finnish man. He's not really Finnish. He's from one of the Arab countries, but he must have been born and raised here. His Finnish is spoken perfectly, and he has a great heart and a great adventurous spirit. And he goes to all of these places in the world, all the different cultures and societies. And lately, it looks like he was in a slum in Haiti. And the disadvantages there are so staggering, that it's just pain, hurtful to watch and see what these people don't have. But somehow they pulled themselves together, and in the middle of this slum, they create a library, and then people donate to the library, and it becomes a very big thing, and people learn to read their way into a higher state of consciousness. It's such a introduction of the light. I must say, I so much admire what this man does as he travels from place to place, appreciating the different cultures as they are, and so many of them are wanting. But he manages to see the good and point out the good and make it available to us so that we can see what the animated spirit of humanity can do, even under very, very adverse circumstances. Maybe, at some point we've all lived under such straitened circumstances. Here in the West now, we've graduated, maybe a little, beyond that. We've suffered much and lifted ourselves and are now pursuing other things, but there are so many members of humanity, maybe to a great extent Earth humanity, who are still suffering greatly in conditions of imprisonment. And service is not taking them out of incarnation in this case, but it certainly is saving their consciousness, liberating their consciousness, releasing them from life circumstances which are unbearable. And naturally, understanding will grow. And one realizes that, they have to do it to a great extent on their own. It's one of the requirements. And when we actually get into the process of self-liberation and release, we're not just dependent upon others. Now, once we begin to do that, others can come in and help, but it's important that we mobilize our resources so that the improvements that occur are undertaken by ourselves as much as may be possible. And thus it is with esotericism. The masters could hand us the formulas, but we have to work our way there into a state of worthiness to receive these formulas. We have to do everything we can do up until the 11th hour, as it were. And then what we cannot do, sometimes the bridge is given. Let's just say Leadbeater did a lot of good with his psychic abilities, but it was Master KH finally who taught him really how to cultivate these and how to use them. So we take ourselves as far as we can go. And then we If we have a good teacher, something additional is given that helps us cross over into a area of greater opportunity. So we have to have a holistic view. We can't just serve emotionally because it causes us pain. We have to really have an inclusive understanding of the conditions of the individual so that what we do is not actually hurtful and causing more problems because of our short-sightedness. And then we have intelligence and love, and otherwise service is given for our own self-satisfaction. That's not really service at all. Now, when the factor of spiritual illumination enters into that service, you have those transcendent lights which have illumined the way of humanity and have acted like searchlights thrown out into the great ocean of consciousness, revealing to man the path he can and must go. And, well, think about the Tibetan as a master, writing letters to those he had known before, let us say, in different circumstances, and somehow providing a way forward for them. He is an illumined master, and he is a transcendent light. And he throws out the searchlight so that people can see and perhaps take a better way. There are so many possibilities here. I'm trying to save without getting all of those bells and whistles. Okay. So we have to learn the way we can and must go, but as the Tibetan has said to us, how much of the mountain of vision have you climbed for yourself? We do stand on the shoulders of giants. The masters are giants. And when I think of what we're seeing because of the Tibetan, it's a huge vista, which we wouldn't see otherwise. But we have to learn also to climb the mountain of vision ourselves. And where there are problems, intervention may occur. But the more we can derive from our own self-understanding, the better and more stable will be the new knowledge. You know, there's that story of Christ and his disciple walking along the seaside. And so there are two pairs of steps, you probably know it, and all of a sudden there's only one pair of steps for a long time. And at the end of it all, the disciple says to the Christ, "Master, why did you abandon me? Why did you leave? Why did you make me travel all by myself?" And the Christ says, "Well, my child, that was the moment that I picked you up and carried you because you were so much in need." So we misinterpret. You know, the masters are ready when our need is great, but we must prove ourselves. We don't want to become dependents. Master Moria tells us that to give all is to put on chains. So it's such a delicate balance. How much do you let your student work out for himself or herself according to his or her own capabilities, and how much do you simply give? So you give where necessary, but you hope that there will be a cultivation of powers from within the individual himself. It says here, "I would like to point out another thing. I have given no specific rules for releasing the prisoners of the planet. I have made no classification of the prisoners, of the prisons and their prisoners, nor of the methods of work, nor of techniques of release." Well, he seems to have, you know, already given quite a bit. He's telling us who these prisoners are. "I urge only," get this straight, "upon each and all who read these instructions, the necessity for renewed effort to fit themselves for service by a conscious and deliberate effort. to develop the intuition and to achieve illumination. I mean, how do we know how to serve unless we can see the need? And it is intuition and illumination that reveal the need, the true need. It's not a guessing game, you see. Every human being who reaches the goal of light and wisdom automatically has a field of influence which extends both up and down, and which reaches both inward to the source of light and outward into the fields of darkness. You see, in the glamour meditation, this is exactly so. You know, you stand with your hands outstretched and you reach into the secret place, but you bring it down into the subtle world of glamour. So there are fields of darkness, and when we are intuitive and illumined, those fields are obvious to us, and our ability to help within those fields greatly increases. When he has thus attained, he will become a conscious center of life-giving force, and will be so without effort, we might say, our radiation will serve, not the desperate effort to serve. He will stimulate, energize, and vivify to fresh efforts all lives that he contacts, be they his fellow aspirants, or an animal, or a flower. Think of that. Even in our relationship to an animal or a flower, we will stimulate new possibilities. Well, certainly Master DK is one of those. We haven't seen him working with the vegetable kingdom or mineral or animal kingdom, but we've seen him working with human beings. And he is a conscious center of life-giving force. And when he contacts us by whatever means, or through letters as it was given to do back in the early arcane school days, then his contact with him yields all these results. He will act as a transmitter of light in the darkness. He will dispel the glamour around him and let in the radiance of reality. Now, how beautiful an objective for all of us. Okay. So this is what we want to be able to do, and when large numbers of the sons of men can so act, then the human family will enter upon its destined work of planetary service. Yeah. Its mission is to act as a bridge, you know, as a bridge. And let's see if my chronometer, oh, there it goes. I have an ongoing war with my chronometer, thus I don't always come in at the hour, or even close to it sometimes. So we have to spread this great teaching, which elevates us to the point where we serve through the quality that we have attained. We serve through radiation. Our mission, humanity's mission, to act as a bridge between the world of spirit and the world of material forms. All grades of matter meet in man, and all states of consciousness are possible to him, which is not the case for all hierarchies. Man can work in all directions and lift the subhuman kingdoms into heaven and bring heaven down to earth. So, the destiny of man and the beauty of that destiny. Well, he's shown us how it is the individual works, and he's also shown how humanity as a whole can work. And since we have come to this point, although I see that my saving ability here, at least in terms of the computer, is quite limited, but we are here on page 539. So if we go, and we began on 532, and so let's transport this down to the place where we're ending, and the reason we're ending here, it just works out very well, in 2 hours instead of three, as I've been doing, it works out well because we're at the beginning of a new chapter, a new rule. So this is the end then of part three, and it's from 532 to 539, and it's rule 12.2, 12.3, and I can't say it's in two parts. Oop. Okay. And we're beginning with program number four. I've decided to do it this way and make sense instead of continuing with the numbering that I started with the astral plane. And we begin at 539. It's going to be rule 13. And it's going to be 13.1. The rules of magic for the physical plane. The magician must recognize the four note in his work, the shade of violet, the evidence, and thus construct the shadow. And this is so the shadow clothes itself, and the four become the seven. We're entering that area where the etheric energy is interfacing effectively with the ancient fires of the dense physical plane. Well, there's so much to study, isn't there, friends? So much to incorporate, so much to understand and relate, and to see within wholeness rather than as separate items of knowledge. Separate items of knowledge are okay, but they should all be interrelated, and the wholeness of their context should be revealed. Okay, then we'll go on with program number four in these rules of magic for the physical plane. It'll be the 13th rule. And this whole section about rules for magic on the physical plane will not be as long, certainly not as long as the discussion of rules for the astral plane. Very, very long. But hopefully, before I have to go to the United States, I'll be able to finish my commentary on this, and you will have some benefit in your studies. I will see you soon. Bye-bye.